UEG Talks, gastroenterology to go. Welcome to our GI podcast. Listen for fresh insights and perspectives in science, education, and professional development.
Hello, everyone. My name is Zagle, and I'm the host of UEG Talks, educational and hopefully fun dive into GI world and beyond. Welcome to another exciting episode. And today we have a trailblazer in the guideline world, a first chair of UEG committee for a quality task force, and a superstar head of the endoscopic unit in the Romantic Casablanca, Wafa Kanusi. Welcome, Wafa.
Hi, Eglo. That's a funny introduction. Thank you very much. Just say really nice things. Trailblazer is maybe too much, but
no, you were the first. You deserve it. You made it from the get-go to this amazing committee that it is right now. We're very, very happy to have you with us, and actually to end your term as the chair, to summarize all the achievements and things to notice about the guidelines, because we're talking about guidelines, the good, the bad, and the ugly.
Wonderful title. I love the movie, by the way.
Okay, so let's get in. To start out light, are the guidelines the holy grail of medical practice, or just the best that we have?
They're pretty much perceived as the holy grail in some circles, but they are definitely something to look up to in terms of reference, but they are definitely not flawless. There are a lot of imperfections, a lot of things to improve in the process of developing guidelines, in the way we are doing it right now. There will be definitely a lot of improvement in the future, including new technologies. But for now, the way we're doing it, it's definitely not perfect. But is it really the thing that we consider as a holy grail? Maybe it's too much as a word, but still, it's pivotal in the clinical decision making. Let's say if you are in a clinical setting, you have a clinical question, you have a patient in front of you at an individual level, you have to have some kind of references if you fail short of taking the decision yourself out of your experience. So you need a reference, and guidelines are there to be in this position of reference for clinical practitioners to answer their questions based on the best gathering of evidence.
Okay, so they're a solid start, but they're not everything encompassing, and they do not change.
They're not perfect.
Okay. We have to bear that.
Yeah, we will discuss this.
Okay. So I was wondering, okay, we have guidelines, but we're in different continents, and traditionally, separate continents have separate guidelines. If theoretically the guidelines are supposed to be written on the entire body of evidence, why are the outcomes so different?
This is a very good question. It can be super puzzling, disturbing for users. You have a clinical question, let's say, pancreatic cysts. This is something I'm very passionate about, all pancreatology. And the cyst, I've followed all the evolution since the beginning. And the guidelines are multiple, and each continent has their own. And it seems completely unrealistic, based on what you just said, that it is supposed to be a gathering of what's best of evidence there. And the reading of evidence should be the same. So the outcome is supposed to be the same. But it's definitely not the case. It's where actually you see that there is a part of experience, expertise, practice, and the panel involved in the development of those guidelines has a say in also. It's not only a gathering of evidence, but there is also a part of expert opinion. And you know, as an expert or experienced practitioner, at a certain point you reach a level of conviction. You are sure, you know, you're sure.
I know better.
This is the way maybe to do it. Or yeah, my outcomes are always the same when I do this way. This is what really the majority of patients, that outcome is this and that. So you are trying to maybe prove your point at a certain point, but this is not how it should happen. Yeah,
yeah.
I agree. But there is a part of expert opinion. And when do the experts around the table are having really the highest level of impact on what's written is when the research is lacking, is when the data is lacking, whether it's lacking at all, there is a gap, complete gap, or the data is not reaching the level of, you know, quality to be considered as a clear reference. So yes, experienced practitioners has to be in this panel, they will express their opinions. There is a round of consensus and voting. And yes, so there is an impact of the panel involved. So that's an explanation. As an expert from different continents, you are having different experiences. You are experiencing different epidemiologies. And the way you do things traditionally may impact also your convictions. So that could lead to different outcomes coming from different continents.
So basically, the beauty is in the eye of the beholder. The one who drafts the guidelines has a say of his own opinions.
Let's take two examples. You have a field of expertise or topic in gastroenterology, let's say, where the evidence is really profuse and you have a lot of data. RCTs are published every year. This is maybe an IBD area. You have a lot of things happening, for example. So there, maybe the expertise, when you have a specific question and you have 10 RCTs, you don't have much of experience included in this. But in areas where the research is lacking, you have retrospective series and so on, this is where you rely most on really experts on the panel to provide their opinions and their expertise. And that's where actually the difference can happen in the guidelines.
But if the data is not there, should it be a consensus or it's a bit different.
That's a terminology difference. There is a range of guidance documents going from the top, which is clinical practice guidelines based on evidence. And maybe in the lower extent, there is a consensus and also expert opinions. I'm not undermining this type of documents. They are needed. When you are a single practitioner in front of a patient in a clinical situation, you don't know exactly how to make a decision in a certain specific situation. You don't have a guideline. You are completely in a difficult situation. So you rely on the most expert person around you to ask for their opinions. So that's what is an expert opinion paper or a consensus paper. It is based on experienced practitioners that express their experience into a paper. And that's very much needed. I'm not saying that it's not good. This is needed when research is lacking, when high quality data is lacking.
It's like democracy, the best that we have. It may not be perfect, but yeah, it's the
best. But, you know, as you said, the beauty is in the eye of the reader, of the beholder, but also as an user, you need to be aware of this. So you could pick the best guidance there is, and you should be aware on how those documents are produced or how the process of production or implementation of these documents is done. So you would know. The critical thinking is very important. And maybe you had a question also about this.
To follow up on the people who are drafting the guidelines, multidisciplinary versus single specialty. We're going towards multidisciplinary, but should we encompass that the ones that are drafted for instance, only by surgeons are very one-sided and may not represent the best recommendations for the patient outcomes?
Multidisciplinary or single specialty, this is a very important question. I think it depends on the topic. You can imagine. You are talking about, I don't know, IBD or HCV, or this is a huge topic. It includes a lot of specialties inside. You are talking about how should I perform this specific anastomosis? Should it be manually, mechanically? This is a highly technical question. And, Egle, I don't think that there is a topic where you can be just by yourself as a specialty, I say, to provide this document. I cannot really think of a single topic where you can be by yourself as a specialty. I think that a patient perspective and nurse's perspective is really missing in a lot of our guidelines. And their perspective is, mostly for patients, is central. This is the central point. This is the end point of all what you are doing, is to provide the best care there is for our patients. And patient's perspective has been included more and more in our way of thinking and our way of taking decisions. This is very important. So even as a surgeon, I think if you include the patient's perspective and nurse's perspective, it could be more valuable. It could be more enriching, even if you're talking about a really highly specific question. So it should be multidisciplinary, I think, from the basis.
Okay. So, and also we have to bear in mind that patient is at the center of every guideline. We want to improve their care and their life quality.
Okay, so now that we have good guidelines, expertly drafted, multidisciplinary, with good methodology, can we stop thinking? Do the guidelines cover everything? Can we just automatically transfer the recommendations to clinical practice?
Critical thinking mode should never be turned off. That's the base. I mean, you always should keep your critical thinking. I was just telling you that as a user, you could not just take everything that is written as something that is, you know,
a commandment.
Yeah, no, it's not. It's there is always imperfection in there. So you need to be just aware about how the documents are made and a specific how to read, actually. That's what I'm trying to teach the young GIs around me or young students also in med school, that to know how to read a document, to know how to read a guideline. This is very important. The title, so you know the scope. Mm-hmm. The panel, you don't know the names, of course, when you are a student, when you are in your young GI, you don't know all the names. So credential, you cannot judge. But a reference from a member society is something that is valuable, you see? Mm-hmm. A highly expert society, including high experts in the field, that's something important. So you should pay attention to the scope, you should pay attention to who is really drafting this document. Methodology, if you're not aware of how the process of a guideline development is made, you could maybe not know to make the difference between a very good, well-processed guideline and another. And also, when you are reading the questions or seeing the answers of the questions, there is always attention to be made when it comes to grading of evidence, mm-hmm. and the level of consensus or recommendation. That's how I teach them how to read. At least when you have a low evidence and a high level of consensus, you know that this is definitely an expert opinion. Okay. It's not based on high quality data, but still it's valuable because it's experts in the field giving this recommendation. It's recommendation. You can take it, you can leave it, depends on your conditions, depends on the situation, but you should be aware of how to read those documents.
So maybe to start before using the guidelines, one should read the UG Quality of Care Task Force
Definitely.
Framework for a quality guidelines.
It's a very simple document. It's not
very good.
It's not necessarily distilled to high experts. It's really made for every user, even students, residents, everyone, to know what's the process of making a guideline. So once you are aware, you know how to use the documents you have.
Yeah, but it covers a lot. It's really nice document to start with the guidelines and methodology in those.
Yeah, sure.
Thank you. It's one of your achievements during your tenure.
It should be updated for now, but it was a very, very good idea because we did that because we felt it was necessary not only to provide good guidelines, but the implementation is always a difficulty and a hurdle to overcome. That's how it is. You can provide the best guideline there is based on really high quality documents, the high quality research, but still it's not used. It's super frustrating. It doesn't translate necessarily into improving or changing the practice. So that's where our work in quality of care was focused on, in how to implement, how to make it really used by endpoint users, which are the practitioners, the young students, etc., etc., how to implement those guidelines.
So also another project came into place, the app.
That's one of the ideas we had and we developed in the quality of care committee. The app, what was the, just to give you a short story. That's very short. How this idea came. It was a dream. Not a dream that was for me completely impossible to achieve at the level where I was, to have an answer of my clinical question as fast as possible based on the best document there is, which are the guidelines, obviously. So there was no tool actually to help me do this. There were some online tools coming from member societies, but they were not translated in a phone, you know, in a kind of an app where you can enter.
Easily accessible.
Yes, where you can enter actually your patient's data quickly and have the decision that you can provide and you can use immediately based on the best evidence there is. And afterwards, that's the beauty of UEG also, is that making your dream really come true. And it was for me just a silly idea. And afterwards, it turned into, you know, the GI guideline apps that you see now.
Yeah, and use it under my table when I don't know the answer.
It's super practical. It's not just putting the guidelines in the app. The documents are there if you want them. There are the summaries. Interactive tools are the main development that we achieved. And the provider was great. And the team working on it, Giovanni Marchegiani, Ian Grannick, and all the members of the working group that were highly, really following up on the tools that we have and providing always a better usability to the app and navigability. So thanks to this team, we have achieved a really good product, I think, for all the users there to answer the clinical questions in a very fast setting and based on the best evidence there is.
Great. It's a great app to use. Definitely. So. Thank you.
We will include more and more guidelines in it. It's just a matter of time. And we are really, member societies are helping a lot. All member societies are helping a lot because they believed in the project and they see the beauty of it and how it disseminates those beautiful documents and highly high quality documents into practical, you know, interactive tools that makes it really highly useful.
Yeah, it is very useful, especially for a younger GI. So once you have guidelines, sometimes you see, for me at least, coming from a less than fortunate country, there are areas that I cannot provide the best possible care for my patient due to lack of funding. So could we use guidelines to improve healthcare decisions, healthcare making decisions? Or the politicians, could we weaponize guidelines to make an impact for patient care?
That's a very complex topic and question. Actually, yes. And also, it's not enough, of course. You can imagine that those scientific documents, when you go and take a guideline and go to the upper leadership of a hospital, leadership of a public healthcare decisioners or stakeholders, they need to know more. The burden of the disease. That's where the white book is very important. They need to know the numbers. Are those guidelines translating into improving patients' outcome, reducing the costs? So the cost level has also a saying in there. When it comes to public healthcare, you need to zoom out from your everyday practice and see the big picture. And the big picture is when you are managing a healthcare facility or a healthcare ministry or public decisioners in the matter, you are taking into consideration all specialties there is, not only GI, not only oncology, not only. So you are managing a huge, huge burden in general. So as a GI, influence better the decisions at that level, you need to prove that the burden of GI diseases is very high. The cost is very high if you don't implement correctly the quality of care that you want to implement. And that's where the PAC and UEG, the PAC is Public Affairs Committee, and UEG are working very, very hard to take actually the burden of GIs to the upper level of decision makers at the level of European Commission to be able to influence better and to give more visibility and to give more importance to GI care and to be able to have decisions that would influence really at a high level the outcome of patients in very high burden diseases like, I don't know, hepatitis or oncological, GI oncology or whatever the topic it is.
So if we're talking about, we have to show that the guidelines improve patient outcomes. Coming from that point, do you think that the guidelines should also be validated for at least short-term outcomes where they could be?
Definitely. Yes, absolutely. You publish a guideline, it's wonderful, high-quality data, the consensus methodology, everything is done by the book. But still, how does it translate into a single patient, how you improve a single patient outcome or a group of patients? That's something that needs to be, of course, researched and inquired after the publication. And I love very much the publications where you take these guidelines, you implement it in a in a facility or in a group of a multidisciplinary team, and you see how you impact really the patient. But again, this guideline should be practiced.
Okay.
Translate into practice first, and then you can achieve an outcome at patient level. And this, you know, two-level process, it doesn't always happen. Guideline is there, not necessarily practiced by the big number of practitioners. And then again, logically, it doesn't translate much into the general outcome of patients. So it has to be in uptake to achieve a raise in uptake, to implement better at a practitioner's level, to be able to study actually the impacts on patients.
Yeah, you cannot study what's not happening.
Yeah. So that's where actually the guidelines are falling short. Is to be translated into practice.
Right, that's why you have a serious point in the application for the guidelines. What's your implementation plan?
Yeah, we had a very good project to disseminate better, implement better guidelines. They were really great. But again, it's single experiences. It should be general for all guidelines there is to be uptake. The uptake should be better and the implementation should be better. Dissemination is not that much complicated now, you know. You put it online and you can really advertise for it. And a lot of people know about it. But does knowing about a guideline makes it really, does it translate systematically into improving practice? To improve practice, as you said, depends on the condition you are working in. You cannot sometimes apply what is written in the guideline because you don't have the drugs, the necessary drugs are not still available in your country or in your facility. So you cannot apply what is already written or what the best data there is suggests. So that's another level of complication. Yeah.
So coming from that, do you think that we should have a cascade guideline project? Like, for instance, IBD, that's a very expensive topic. Mm-hmm. The treatments are very expensive. So should the guidelines provide the second best option?
Mm-hmm. Yes, very interesting question. Some guidelines have done that. Some panels, some societies, member societies have tried to do this. For emergency, for example, ESGE for upper GI bleeding, they've done that. They've done it really beautifully. And the point there is to cascade the guidelines means that you provide the minimum level of care. And afterwards, the more facilities you have, abilities you have, devices you have, you can achieve more and more and more. And as you said, coming from a country where availability of all what is out there in the world is not necessarily present all the time, you can really benefit from this kind of cascaded guidelines, saying, okay, I'm in a small hospital, I don't have a high level of endoscopy or endoscopists, I have an upper GI or ERCP emergency or complicated situation, what do I do, etc., etc. So this cascaded guideline is really, really needed. And I think that all guidelines should be transformed in this way, in a way that's to stand or to state actually the minimum level of care and afterwards come in with different other levels or upper level, advanced levels, if you have the ability to do that.
So it's not one model fits all. Mm-hmm. We do the best that we can and we try to improve what at each have. Step. Yes. you are doing the best that you can with what you
with
have.
What you have, yeah.
Should it be included in the UEG proposals, like to provide not only the best option, but some other, maybe less optimal options? But
yeah,
do you think so?
Actually, in the Quality of Care Committee, what we do is to fund, to stimulate, to help and accompany all the guideline developers. We don't do that ourselves. The committee is there to receive applications and really select applications and fund actually those projects, which are really outstanding ones in very highly needed areas, gap areas. But yes, it's included in our criteria to be multidisciplinary, to be inclusive, diversity, and to have the best panel there is and credentials from the panel, etc. The cascaded is not a mandatory option for now. But it's highly, highly encouraged, for sure. It's highly encouraged. But where we are working to improve this part is to work on quality indicators. I don't know if it's for you completely related to the question, but quality indicators are, for me, the best way to improve patients' outcome. Defining the best quality of what we do every day, this is stating actually the minimum requirements. For example, you are probably familiar with ESG equality improvement or quality criteria for endoscopy in general. And having that published, you have a reference. You know what you should be doing. That's the best you should be doing. And of course, if you can do better, that's good. But the minimum for high quality upper GI endoscopy or colonoscopy, what are the best practices for polypectomy, et cetera, this is a way to really improve practice and improve outcomes. That's for me the best way to go. We are working on a new project now on quality improvement in pancreatic cancer. This is very, very close to my heart. And I think it's going to be a very successful also project.
Great. Also a tremendous effort on the quality of care committee, because the GI tract is so wide. Endoscopy is one thing. It's technical, but the GI tract is so vast.
Yeah, true.
A bit daunting, but
true. But really, member societies are doing really fantastic job. They are really working in multidisciplinary way to improve really all the level of care in general.
Very cool. So we've covered so much, from methodology, how guidelines are drafted, to how they should be implemented. So let's end where we started. You are a trailblazer in the efforts of the quality of care. You have been the first chair of quality of care task force, now a committee. You have built something enormous from scratch, and it has become an essential committee paramount to the efforts of UEG, and you have wide range of activities from the guideline initiatives to the app. And what is the most important takeaway from this experience that you had in UEG and the quality of care?
It's been fun. I've enjoyed every second of it, every meeting, every hurdle, The team was great. It's a team effort, you know. Thank you for saying the trailblazer, but really it was a team effort. The leadership was supportive from the beginning, and it started with a vision from Axel Dignas, a former president, you know him. And he was the one who stimulated the creation of the Standards and Guidelines Task Force back then. And it was a small group really trying to make guidelines better and implement it better, disseminate it better, because it's important for patient care. And from there, the adventure started, and it took now 7 years developing this task force into a committee, because the leadership and, of course, the OGI world feels that quality is very important and something that needs to be worked on more and more. And it's not discrepancies in quality of care throughout the world and throughout Europe are so large and vast that it needs to be tackled urgently to improve the general patient care. So the committee took really a big place, because there was a lot of efforts actually in the team of this committee, the task force first, then the committee, to do their best, highly motivated representatives for all member societies. That's what it takes actually to success. They are really taking the time to do their best in all the projects that we are doing. Activity grant selection is a nightmare, you know. The activity grant criteria has evolved dramatically those last 7 years. And we have done a really great job to be able to fund the best projects there is. The app was a dream, a success, and it was fantastic to have this ability to answer our questions as fast as possible. And it helps. The next step is to study how it really impacts the outcome of patients. That's the next step. And quality criteria are really important to state. So it takes really high encouragement from leadership. It takes a very highly motivated team. And that's the case. The office has been not just crazy people working all day to make our job so easy, to make our meetings so efficient. And I thank really everyone, starting with Axel Dignas, who encouraged me to take this position and to help me at the beginning. He was the lead of the task force, and then he handed over to me. And afterwards, I had the chance to work with Elizabeth Saylor, with Doris, with Verena, with Vilma, with everyone in the team that you know, who are really highly encouraging and making our job so easy. And I think the Quality of Care Committee has a bright, bright days in front of it. And yes. This is Giovanni Marchegiani taking over now. He has been elected yesterday. So congratulations, Giovanni, if you're listening. And I'm sure he's going to do a fantastic job and continue this adventure.
It's hard to screw up what you've already built. I mean, it's implemented well. There are rules and boundaries.
It's just a team effort.
Wafa, thank you so much for spending this time and sharing your expertise with us today. And thank you for all your efforts in the quality of care.
Thank you, Egler. You have been part of this quality of care. You have, for sure, you can give us your opinion, because I think it was a family vibe. And I enjoyed so much being in the room together and discussing all the projects that we are doing. And you have been a big part of it, too. And I'm so happy that YTG, a young talent group, is appointing a representative each time. And it has always been a member who is super active and pushing us to the edge of all the topics. And I think you have been also a very, very great help.
Thank you. It was my pleasure. The quality of care, sorry, I will be very brutal, but it's the best committee in the
sorry
UT.
For the others coming.
Yes, sorry. Thank you guys for listening. Thank you, Wafa, for your
time. Thank you so much.
See you later.
Bye.